Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. Happy Star Wars Day to you.
May the 4th be with you.
Always.
Thanks for letting me say it. I appreciate that. I figured you'd jump, that you would have to just jump all over that. So,
I mentioned it last year. We mentioned Star Wars Day. I think that may have our show may have fallen on May the 4th that time too. I was just wondering before the show, Phil, how long have we had Star Wars Day? When did the witty guy who And it was almost certainly a guy who came up with the idea of May the 4th ought to be Star Wars Day.
Some Star Wars fan at some point said, hey, May the 4th be with you, right? And the rest is history. May 4th became, I think, unofficially, right? I believe that the mail was still delivered today and so forth. But still a significant day for those of us who dig this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the bank might have been closed, but yeah, the mail got delivered. So exactly.
Now, our topic this evening is actually Grab Your Future, and I want to tell you that a regular listener who will remain nameless was giving me some feedback on this title for the show tonight, Grab Your Future. And the feedback was, are you guys running out of shows, names for your show? And I said, no, what do you mean? And she said, well, you're closing in on I Got Your Future right here.
Yeah, I got your future.
I said, I don't think that's true, but we'll make the case that Grab Your Future is actually a valid title.
Actually, I was pretty cool. Oh, God.
I was really riffing off a grab bag, right? We every now and then we do these grab bag shows where we're just talking about general topics, whatever is of interest to us related to the future. And I thought, okay, we'll do a grab bag show. Instead of calling it a grab bag show, I said, you know, mix it up a little bit. But I think, you know, with that in mind, we are going to have to do a show somewhere down the road called I Got Your Future Right Here, don't you think?
Okay. Yeah, well, that deserves a book or a movie or something, you know. I mean, we...
that should be a book, absolutely.
Yeah.
That could be a series on the Discovery Channel, I think, probably. Well, yeah. I note that Sally is in the chat room.
You need the right guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
exactly.
after Jersey Shore finishes its run, we get one of them to host I Got Your Future Right Here. Anyway, glad to note Sally's back. Sally, welcome back, our chat host. Sally has been making the move, the annual trek from up north to down south. She's now safely ensconced in. Oh, she says she's got no sound. Well, we're talking to you anyway, Sally. Down there in Arizona, so we're very pleased to have you with us this evening. So I guess we can just jump right into it, Stephen. We've got various topics, as I said, related to the future, talking about opportunities, really, that we have for experiencing a different kind of future than what we might have expected. And I'll start, unless you've got one you want to start with.
No, go for it, man.
Well, I put a story up this morning on the blog with the provocative headline, The World's First Trillionaires Will Make Their Money in Space. And this is actually an argument from Peter Diamandis, the guy who founded the XPRIZE Foundation. And he says that basically, to quote him, there are $20 trillion checks, $20 trillion checks, I need to intonate that correctly, up there waiting to be cashed. And he's talking about the mineral wealth of the near-Earth asteroids, that is the asteroids that are within what we think of as, I guess, the asteroid belt, but that have an orbit that brings them fairly close to the Earth from time to time. So he's tracking what he describes as a price improvement curve. What used to take $1 billion and 20,000 people to get a space shuttle into orbit can now happen, he says, with a team of 20 people funded by a single individual. And his notion is that in the evolution of space travel, the military-industrial complex of Boeing, Lockheed, and NASA are the dinosaurs, and today's entrepreneurs are the furry mammals. So that's, you know, pretty provocative language. Obviously, Peter Diamandis is all about being the founder of the XPRIZE. He's all about moving us in a direction of privatization of space and making the economic case. Now, what do you think, Stephen? If there's an economic case for space exploration, is it asteroid mining, or is it would you go with something else?
Well, there's asteroid mining, and there's also a very close resource on the moon, helium-3. Helium-3 is thought to be, well, it's known to be abundant on the moon and rare on the Earth, and
right.
It's thought to be the perfect fuel for a nuclear reactor. And I think specifically fusion. I mean, if we ever get fusion working, it's thought to be the I may be wrong about that. I should look that up before I say it. Helium-3, though, is thought to be an extremely valuable source of fuel, and that's very, very close, and it's extremely common on the moon. And so that could, you know, you could have a trillionaire from that. But I was also thinking, you know, rare earth elements in the asteroid belt. We know that China produces about 97% of the rare earth elements that are needed for various forms of technology, like computers, iPhones, you name it. And they have tightened their exports of it, and it's made it made these rare earth elements even more rare, I guess. You know, that of course sends the price of technology derived items up.
Well, two things would have to happen there, though. I mean, seriously, two things would have to happen there for that to become viable. Okay, China would have to jack the price way, way up, and the
right.
price of going out into space to get things would have to come way, way down. Now Diamandis says that's what's happening, that the price is coming way, way down. But for it to be cheaper to go out into space and get something that's available on Earth, that's going to be a very tight market on Earth and a very inviting going into space market, don't you think?
Yeah, I would think so. But think once you get into space, you know, the majority of getting in, majority of the cost of getting into space is the breaking Earth orbit. Once you've broken Earth orbit, and you know, if once you have a craft that could do that and carry all that's needed to get out to an asteroid and perhaps push it back into, you know, maybe lunar orbit or high Earth orbit or something. And then, I mean, you could have a mining operation fairly close to Earth. And then when you have a good payload, you just you could just put, you know, nudge it a little bit and get it home that way. So, I mean, it'd be extremely high initial costs and then maybe manageable costs after that. You know, and it, like you say, it would require them to crack down on exporting that to the point that they were basically just saying the rest of the Earth can't have this. We here in China are going to take it all. So, you know, if they were to do that to us, then it might become very valuable to go into space if the elements that we need could be found in the asteroid belt. And quite honestly, I'm not sure if that's true or not. But lots of elements are out there, though, huh?
Well, there's lots of mineral wealth to be had out there, for sure.
Yep.
And if you can get there cheap enough, you can make it worth your while. You know, diamonds, right, would be one of the things that it would still have to be a lot cheaper than it is now to get there. But you can imagine the curve getting to that point, right? It's like, okay, if I can get to those diamonds and bring them back, you know, that's
all of a sudden I've paid for 10 more trips, you know. So yeah, you can exactly, if you can just finance the initial trip.
Well, I would apologize to those listeners who don't have sound, but they can't hear me. But Sally in the chat room reports that she's not getting sound. She's getting some error sign over the fast forward radio sign. So don't know what's going on with that. We've had a little bit of funky behavior from Blog Talk Radio the last few weeks, haven't we? This is the first time we've had a sound problem, though. Well, Sally has logged out. Maybe it could be a problem on her end.
Well,
there's no point talking to the people with ears.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
We have one listener who's reporting he hears us. So
okay. Ken, this show is all for you, bud, as always. It's and then Thuris can hear us, too. So yeah, with all that in mind, I was really intrigued to see same day. Sometimes these things just work out really nicely. Brian Wong over on Next Big Future published an open letter from Elon Musk. Now, Elon Musk, as we know, the guy behind SpaceX, he's got a letter, open letter he's written, why the U.S. can beat China, the facts about SpaceX costs. And this is so good, I thought I would just go ahead and, if you will indulge me, I'm just going to read, it's not that long, read this letter from Elon Musk on the subject of why the U.S. can still win the space race. He begins, whenever someone proposes to do something that has never been done before, there will always be skeptics. So, when I started SpaceX, it was not surprising when people said we wouldn't succeed. But now, we've successfully proven Falcon 1, Falcon 9, and Dragon. There's been a steady stream of misinformation and doubt expressed about SpaceX's actual launch costs and prices. As noted last month by a Chinese government official, SpaceX currently has the best launch prices in the world, and they don't believe they can beat them. This is a clear case of American innovation trumping lower overseas labor rates. I recognize that our prices shatter the historical cost models of government-led developments, but these prices are not arbitrary, premised on capturing a dominant share of the market, or teaser rates meant to lure in eager market only to be increased later. Wouldn't that be something if they were like doing teaser, you know, bait-and-switch pricing on space launches? These prices are based on known costs and a demonstrated track record, and they exemplify the potential of America's commercial space industry. Here are the facts. The price of a standard flight on Falcon 9 rocket is $54 million. We are the only launch company that publicly posts this information on our website. We have signed many legally binding contracts with both government and commercial customers for this price or less. Because SpaceX is so vertically integrated, we know and can control the overwhelming majority of our costs. This is why I'm so confident that our performance will increase our price and our prices will decline over time, as is the case with every other technology. The average price of a full-up NASA Dragon cargo mission to the International Space Station is $133 million, including inflation, or roughly $115 million in today's dollars. And we have a firm, fixed-price contract with NASA for 12 missions. This price includes the cost of the Falcon 9 launch, the Dragon spacecraft, all operations, maintenance, and overhead, and all of the work required to integrate with the space station. If there are cost overruns, SpaceX will cover the difference. This concept may be foreign to some traditional government space contractors that seem to believe that cost overruns should be the responsibility of the taxpayer. The total company expenditures since being founded in 2002 through the 2010 fiscal year were less than $800 million, which includes all the development costs for the Falcon 1, Falcon 9, and Dragon. Included in this $800 million are the costs of building launch sites at Vandenberg, Cape Canaveral, and I don't know how to pronounce the name of this island, Kwajalein, and as well as the corporate manufacturing facility that can support up to 12 Falcon 9 and Dragon missions per year. This total also includes the cost of 5 flights of Falcon 1, 2 flights of Falcon 9, and 1 up and back flight of Dragon. $800 million bought all those space flights. Can you imagine what does $800 million get you with NASA, I'm wondering?
they can fuel up the shuttle.
No. Yeah, maybe you get one half a shuttle launch or something like that. Anyway, he carries on in that vein, and he ends with, for the first time in more than three decades, America last year began taking back international market share in commercial satellite launch. This remarkable turnaround was sparked by a small investment NASA made in SpaceX in 2006 as part of the Commercial Orbit Transportation Services program. A unique public-private partnership, COTS has proven that under the right conditions, a properly incentivized contractor, even an all-American one, can develop extremely complex systems on rapid timelines and a fixed price basis, significantly beating historical industry costs. China has the fastest growing economy in the world, but the American free enterprise system, which allows anyone with a better mousetrap to compete, is what will ensure the United States remains the world's greatest superpower of innovation. So here's what's really interesting to me about this letter. I mean, obviously Elon Musk blowing his own horn here and trying to rally the troops around buying American, because that's good for his business if they buy American versus Chinese launches. But when I'm reading this letter, you know, it doesn't feel like I'm reading about this could be a guy talking about cars. Right. This could be laundry detergent at this point. You know what I mean? I mean, this is just a very day to day. Here's why our stuff's better than their stuff. Business comparison. And it shows you how incredibly far we've come that you can get this. And no offense to Elon Musk's writing style, but this almost kind of, you know, banal business writing about something that should be so exciting and mysterious and romantic. Right. Space travel. But I guess my point is, when it's boring business stuff, it's really happening.
exactly. Yeah.
The more boring the riding,
the more excited we get. Exactly.
Yeah. Because that just goes to show you. I mean, he's really working on trying to build market share. This is an actual business, and if it is an actual business, then all of Diamandis's kind of out there sounding predictions about people becoming trillionaires, they don't sound so out there anymore. You know, it's not just pie in the sky. People are eating pie on Earth now, related to the space business, and that's a big shift. That's something that we have seen really come into the fore during the lifetime of this program.
That's right. And so, based on these numbers, Phil, what do you think of mining asteroids at this point? I mean, like you say, huge cost on the first few missions, but once you get the business rolling, and you're bringing in these valuable minerals, whatever they turn out to be,
what you're going to see is Musk and competitors of Musk, including the Chinese government, who you know are not going to take this lying down, right? They're going to start scaling. They're going to start doing more and more for less and less, and those costs are going to continue to go down. I also think that you'll see a lot more than just mine. You know, I'm not sure that mining is the killer app. Maybe mining is the killer app. It'd be really cool if a moon colony mining for helium-3 is the future of space travel. I think that would be very exciting. But there are other possibilities. One that doesn't sound as likely, but I think there possibly could be something there, is that space tourism really pushes us into space. That as those costs go down, more and more people want to get up there just for the thrill of getting up there, and you start building infrastructure. You build infrastructure, satellites in orbit that serve as hotels. Pretty soon you've got one in orbit around the moon. Maybe eventually you've got a resort on the moon again as the prices are going down and down and down. And people are moving out into space, suddenly you've got that infrastructure there, and somebody says, well, you know, we could really start digging up some of that helium-3 on the moon, since there's regular flights there now and there's places to live and all those kinds of things. So the order in which it happens could be different than all that is to say, we're not clear on what the order necessarily has to be, but I think there's enough incentive to get out there with the marginal cost going down and down and down, that sooner or later, the mineral wealth out there becomes a major attractor, and that truly pushes us out into deeper space.
You know, another thing we have not mentioned is space solar. That's a huge potential energy production plant. I mean, night or day, it doesn't matter. You have a solar platform in space, and it beams home by way of microwave the power that's produced in space, and so you get that infrastructure set up, and it would pay for itself as well. So I mean, we're getting more and more efficient with solar all the time, and so. That could be another thing that would propel us, give us reason to be there. You know, other than you know, planting flags on the moon for political purposes, you know, beating the Soviets in the space race, or even just real blue sky science that, you know, doesn't really have any. If we're actually making money in space, if there are ways to make money out there, that's what really will take us there.
That's what gets us there in a more permanent way. I agree. The space race against the Soviets was spectacular and glorious, and we went to the moon, but it was a huge expense. And after we won the race, there was no reason to continue, and it's why we haven't been back up to this point. Those kinds of we want to plant our flag motivators, which I think has been a big driver for China and India as well as they're moving into space. That tends to be a dead end. But leave it to the Chinese. They're now seeing it as, you know, it's a profit center, right? They were all about, we're going to have the fastest space program. We're going to get to the moon faster than anyone else ever did. And now they're completely about competing with Elon Musk and you know, trying to get a share of the low Earth orbit business. Another one that we didn't mention is manufacturing, zero gravity manufacturing. The tolerances that you have there—they're actually very likely to be in the future a market for goods that are produced in zero gravity. And of course, the only reliable way to have that would be to have your factory in space. Now, chances are that would be a almost completely automated factory. We're not going to have assembly lines with dozens or hundreds of people on them out in space. But even so, like with the solar, there's going to be infrastructure up there. There's going to be a reason to be up there, and there will have to be people going back and forth, and all of those can contribute to kind of our movement out into space. So lots of opportunities for us to grab our space future there, I think.
Absolutely. Zero gravity manufacture, that important for it would be helpful to for some pharmaceuticals, I understand.
That's right.
And various forms of crystals. The idea is that you can grow extremely pure or perfect crystals in zero G or something like that to be useful for certain technologies. I need to know more about that. That's another area to read up on.
Yeah, much more precise production of those. Those crystals. I think as we move deeper into nanotechnology, little irritants like gravity can really start to become a major factor. And it's possible that as we're trying to produce things at a finer and finer level, zero gravity manufacturing will become a bigger issue.
Yeah.
Okay. So much for grabbing the future on space. What do you got for us in terms of a grabbable future.
Grabbable futures. I am reading, Phil, a book that is just a fun book to read. It is called An Optimist's Tour of the Future. And one curious man sets out to answer what's next. The author, and let me grab that author's name real quick, is... let's see here. I apologize. It's Mark Stevenson is the author. And he has approached futurism. It's sort of an interesting thing. He had perhaps what was kind of a health scare a couple of years back. And then after the health scare, he kind of wonders himself, well, you know, what's next for me? What does the future hold? And one of the first questions he asked was, well, how much time do I have? You know, I mean,
right.
And of course,
how much future do I get? Exactly.
Exactly. And so, you know, obviously none of us are promised tomorrow. I mean, there's always the random, you know, bus out of nowhere that runs us over. But, you know, if all goes well, you know, what are we looking at? And so he found it interesting that looking out into the future, he's obviously going to live longer now than would have been expected at his birth.
Right.
There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, he's managed to survive to this age. He's in his mid to late 30s. He all the potential hazards of being born. He didn't succumb to. no problems in childhood that cost him his life. He didn't do anything crazy when he got his driver's license that killed him. So all these things that he managed to avoid, he's gotten to this age. So he's expected to live to a higher age now because of that reason than he would have when he was born. But it goes beyond that. He found it fascinating that life expectancy for an infant born today is greater than it was for an infant born when he was born. And that, of course, as he got into this, he got to meet Nick Bostrom and then later Aubrey de Grey, and he began to get into these ideas. What is keeping us from conquering aging? And like you and I, Phil, he found the subject fascinating. He expressed some doubts along the way, but every doubt that was raised was answered by an argument from some of these people like Aubrey de Grey. And I thought one of the more interesting ones was what about the societal upheaval that would come with conquering aging? Our whole world is
built around as if we haven't dealt with that one, huh? Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, our whole world is built around this idea that, we live a certain amount of time and we grow old and we die.
Right.
And Aubrey de Grey's argument and that he actually expressed on this show a while back was that, there will be societal upheaval, no doubt. It'll be one of the most profound and changing things that's ever come about. But if it's, there'll be some bad things we'll have to deal with. But if it's not worse than 100,000 people dying every day, then don't bother me with that. With that argument.
That's right.
And I thought it's interesting from time to time to read someone like ourselves, Phil, who at one time didn't understand some of the arguments that within the transhumanist community, being confronted with it, basically coming around, understanding and what would you have to do? Another thing that came up in the book: what would you have to do if you thought that anti-aging is a terrible thing, and what Aubrey de Grey is doing? You basically have to shut down medicine, because Every medical advance that's made is, we move so, our advances are, you can't really make an advance without moving towards, these goals in some way or another.
Why I always like to frame the life extension argument in those terms, because if you say we're going to extend human life, then you get this whole crazy – well, I mean, it's not crazy. I do understand where the argument comes from. But you get this whole thing about, oh, no, societal upheaval. People will live too long. We'll have too many people, this whole argument. When you say we're going to cure cancer, no one says that, right?
Yeah.
Nobody says, oh, with all these people not dying of cancer, the world's going to go to hell. Nobody ever says that. If every time there's an advance made against cancer or heart disease or diabetes or AIDS, people are glad about that. And
right.
what they don't recognize is that all of those extend human life, that they're actually making the average human lifespan longer. And all we're talking about is not only addressing those big obvious ones, but also the little subtle ones that finally get you in the end too.
There's an analogy that could be made. Michael Shermer once in response, I believe it was him, in response to somebody that was saying, well, I can accept, microevolution, subtle changes within species, but I can't buy, macroevolution where, a one-cell organism eventually becomes a, multicellular animal, which, becomes all these different animals. Can't buy that.
Uh-huh.
He says, well, if you buy microevolution, you get macroevolution for free.
That's right.
It comes along. It comes along for the ride. Well, the same could be said of, any medical advances that we make at all.
The whole history of medicine has been the history of life extension. Absolutely.
Exactly.
That's the bottom line on that. I agree completely.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's a fascinating book. I barely gotten into it. I bought it this afternoon, but so far I'm enjoying it very much. An Optimist Tour of the Future. So, anybody else want to pick it up? They can read along with me, and we can, you know, have a discussion in the chat room.
Well, we'll put outreach to Mark Stevenson to see if he wants to come on and talk with us at some point. I'll go ahead and download that. See what I've become. I don't even buy books anymore. I'll download that on my iPhone and read it, and we'll see if
I've sucked you in, Phil. I mean,
I have officially lost
the
bet
as
of saying that. I think, right?
Yeah.
there's no winning for me now.
Yeah.
I'll put a note down that it sounds like he'd be an interesting guy to have on the program. Well, Sally says she guesses she'll have to listen to the show later. I was really hoping that she could hear this because I wanted to give our update on the World Transform 2, which will be starting June 29th. And let me just read off to you, Stephen, the list of people we've got participating. It has grown significantly since we last spoke. So here's
okay.
who we've got lined up to participate in World Transform 2. David Brin, PJ Manny, Aubrey de Grey, Terry Grossman, Gregory Benford, Maria Konovalenko, Christine Peterson, J. Storrs Hall, Are You Serious, James Hughes, Bruce Katz, Natasha Vita Moore, Martin Ford, Brian Wong, Alexis Bright, and John Smart.
Man, I'm excited about that. That is some serious luminaries. So you don't even have to like Phil and I. I mean, just come to
exactly. We will hardly even be, you know, it won't be like this show at all. Okay. It won't be just
exactly.
going
there'll,
on.
There'll be some brilliance being shown. So please, you know, come and enjoy. So
everyone
yeah.
wants to be part of the World Transform 2. It's going to be a very exciting series. That is about half of the people who've been invited. So I'm really pleased that we've already got 50. We're already at 50% of our guests. Some of the names I will not read the really marquee names until they. Now I can't read any of the rest of the names because then I'm saying that person isn't a really marquee name. But well, I could say, you know, like Alvis Bridges. Alvis, you know, if you're listening, read your email. We'd like you to be on the program. Michael Anisimov, same way. Come on, guys. What's going on here? Who else can I talk to that way? I know who else. George Dvorsky. Dude, come on.
Absolutely.
You missed it last time.
We've enjoyed having them on the show many times. So and they're, you know, awesome futurists, awesome transhumanists. They have some very interesting ideas. So come on, guys, answer your email. We'll get you on.
Yeah, exactly. And Ben,
we'll get you on this
thing. Ben said he'd be on next time if PJ was on, and of course PJ is going to be on. So anyway, that accounts for another third or so of them. And we'll be working on. Yeah, we're going to try to get as many of these folks on as we can. It's going to run 10 weeks. We will have anywhere from 2 to 4 guests on per week. Some of them will be panel discussions with 2 or 3 people on, all discussing at the same time. Some of them will be shows that are divided between one interview in the first half and another interview in the second half. It really depends. Some of these people are a little harder to schedule than others, and sometimes it's hard to get 2 people together at the same time. So it's driven by that. It's also driven by the topic. But the topics I discussed on the World Transform 1.5 on Saturday, and we'll be putting those up on the website here very soon, and we're going to be putting out, over the next few weeks, a lot more information about the series. I think it's going to be tremendous fun, and obviously just really looking forward to it.
Absolutely.
So having said that, I guess now we can swing it on back around and talk about Star Wars.
Absolutely. Well... Okay, so I found out. The first Star Wars day was in 2007. So it's not, you know, it's pretty new.
It's fairly recent. Okay, another thing that has happened within the run of Fast Forward Radio.
That's right.
In fact, I think we can say those are the 2 major things that have occurred during the run of Fast Forward Radio has been the rapid commercialization of space and Star Wars Day. Those are the two
equally biggies. Important in their own way.
Yeah, well, in its each in its own sphere. Well, let's talk a little Star Wars because it is Star Wars Day, and it only occurred to me after the fact that it was. So I thought we'd leave some time to get into it. And I've got some technology stuff I want to say about Star Wars, but I want to talk about a conversation that I've had recently with a friend of mine who is very pro Star Wars in an anti Star Trek kind of a way. Now, have you had this argument? It seems to be something that, that you might encounter, Stephen, because you're younger than me. To me, it feels like a younger generation kind of a thing, that you have camps, right? And either you're in the Star Wars camp or you're in the Star Trek camp. I grew up at a time when we were so starved for this kind of stuff. It was just like so awesome that there was Star Trek reruns on TV, and then Star Wars came along, and you know, no one was going to complain about any of it. That it was all
it's
good.
It's even broken down into you know, further, you know, subset denominations. You got the Picard crowd versus the, you know, the Captain Kirk crowd.
For sure, Star Trek fans are going to fight amongst themselves about that kind of stuff forever, right?
Yeah.
But the idea that the world is divided into people who like Star Trek versus people who like Star Wars, and I know that Sally, this is a whole show for Sally, and she can't hear it. I'm really disappointed that she's not able to hear it. Sally's a big Star Wars fan. Now, on the Star Trek Star Wars divide, if you had to pick, Stephen, where would you put yourself?
I don't know. I be quite honest. I love both. The original trilogy is awesome. The more recent trilogy, good try. I applaud the effort.
That's a pretty kind review, I think, actually.
That's right. Star Trek has had its ups and downs, hasn't it? But the latest movie, the reboot movie, I thoroughly enjoyed, and I think I like it better every time I see it. I've probably seen the new Star Trek movie that was entitled simply Star Trek. I've probably seen that movie, I don't know, maybe a half dozen times. And every time I watch it, there's some little thing I might pick up that I've missed before, but it's just a fun movie. And,
six times you've watched that.
I imagine, yeah, at least that many times. It's not hard when you own the DVD and you got kids that love it, and you know it comes down to, you know, that or one of their other six favorites that they kind of have on high rotation, you know. So.
Yeah. No. I can't even count the number of times I've seen. Well, this is getting pretty sad too. Probably Star Trek 2 and 3, because really, if you watch one, you then don't you think you really need to watch the other? I mean, kind of just to kind of finish the story. But
actually 4 is you kind of have to watch 4 then.
You should watch 4. That's right. Those three kind of go in a row. You really should.
That's
get
a
all
trilogy
three going.
There. 2, 3, and 4 is a trilogy. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, many years ago I used to when I was young. I mean, you know, like out of school. I used to run a video store, and for the young people listening, video used to be on tapes, and people used to go to stores and rent them. Okay, it was an odd, quaint time, and the actual owner of the store, I was the manager. The owner of the store, her two teenage sons worked there, and the younger boy was the biggest Star Trek fan you'll ever meet. Okay, he was just so into Star Trek. And so every Saturday, I would go open the store up, and we would put those. As a matter of fact, we would watch all three of those. I mean, it's not that like we were just watching TV, because we were, you know, stocking the shelves and renting movies to customers. But I mean, those three movies were on in that sequence: Star Trek 2, 3, and 4, like every Saturday. And I worked there, I guess, for like a year and a half. So I've probably seen those three movies. What would that be? I don't know. 50 times anyway, maybe 75 times I've seen those three movies. So maybe if I come down on the Star Trek side of the fence, it's just because I've had it really kind of drilled into you. Yeah, it's really been drilled into me in a way. But I think there's something to be said for that. As you pointed out, that first trilogy, it was just so much fun. It came out when I was 14 years old, and it just the first one. Just such a departure from any other movie that had been made up to that point, such a departure from anything anyone else was doing at that time, and it really kind of created the film industry that we have today. You can trace so much of what happens in the movies today back to Star Wars. So I think it's important culturally, and also just an awful lot of fun. The Star Wars movies were an awful lot of fun. I think Star Trek is maybe important in a way that Star Wars isn't. Just in that Star Trek is, well, here's the real difference. Star Trek is set in the future. So yeah. As a futurist, I really like Star Trek. Star Wars is not really set in the future.
Right, right. And, of course, there's futuristic technology, but it's not even connected with our civilization in any way. It's supposed to be in a galaxy far, far away. So presumably these human-looking people that are walking around speaking English, they're not even human, apparently. So, that fictional universe has nothing to do with ours at all. So except that we just love those characters. And so,
yeah. Well, we do. We love the stories. We love the technology. We love the robots. We love the monsters. I mean, I love everything about the Star Wars universe. Don't get me wrong. I think it's all fun. But science fiction author David Brin, who I believe I mentioned earlier, will be joining us for The World Transformed 2, has written pretty extensively about the fact that Star Wars is really more of a fantasy, really more of a set of fantasy stories than it is science fiction. That that it looks to the past, it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and that what Tobias Buchel would call the tropes, the major themes that occur in Star Wars are mythic. You know,
right.
George Lucas was reading Joseph Campbell. That's what's inspiring him when he comes up with the idea of Star Wars. And so it's all very much looking to the past, and there's ideas like royalty, there's like nobility, there's destiny.
It would have been very easy for J.R.R. Tolkien to have written that story and based it in Middle Earth. It would have been very easy.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
it
right.
It replaced a couple of the things, a couple of the pieces of technology that you see in the movie. Replace it with fantasy elements, and you're good.
In fact, when Star Wars came out, critics remarked the first Star Wars, A New Hope, if you will, a movie that I call Star Wars. When it first came out, critics noted the similarity, and it really is pretty striking visually and just in pacing and everything else between Luke and Han and Chewie going to rescue the princess from the Death Star, and the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Man going to rescue Dorothy from the Witch's Castle in The Wizard of Oz. You know, I mean, those two sequences have an awful lot in common, actually, when you look at them. And when you look at the Star Trek universe, you don't see a lot in common with Tolkien or with The Wizard of Oz or, with fantasy or with fairy tales, because they really are speaking pretty different languages.
Yeah. And you classify both as science fiction, but science fiction is a broad, broad, canvas. Tobias Buchel has recently on our show, and he's published a short story collection of really some of his, quote, failed short stories.
He was on talking about that a few weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah, and every one of these short stories, he's playing with different elements. And some of these short stories, it's a complete fantasy, and then others, it's hard sci-fi. It's like he really wanted to try it all out when he was young, and then decide how, in which direction to push as he developed his craft. And So it's an interesting book, not only for the short stories, but how he talks about the short stories and how it developed his developed his art as he was maturing as a writer. I'll get the title of that book here in just a second. But yeah, it was a pretty good one. It just shows how broad science fiction is.
It is very broad, and it's not fair for me to say that Star Wars isn't science fiction, because really it is. It's spaceships and robots and all those things. But it's the vocabulary of science fiction, but I don't know, the grammar and syntax are fantasy or something. There's something fundamentally fairy tale about Star Wars, and I mean that's the appeal. And I like fantasy. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that fantasy stories aren't great too. Just that just that truly Star Trek was at least in part designed to look ahead. That Roddenberry, not a great visionary, a TV guy, right? A guy who wanted to make an entertaining TV series, but he had a few ideas about, well, let's project a positive view of the future, which was a pretty radical thing to do in the late 60s. When most views of the future that you would see in fiction were very, very dystopic.
But they're people.
Most of them starred Charlton Heston and were quite horrifying, actually. But Star Trek kind of stood out as it was this. We're gonna make it. We're gonna be okay. We're not gonna destroy ourselves in a nuclear war. We're going to invent new technology. We're gonna conquer poverty. We're gonna conquer illness. A lot of the things that we talk about on this program. So kind of proto-transhumanist in its way, I think, Star Trek is. But that's also a thing that Star Trek has in common with Star Wars, because Star Wars is also ultimately, I think, what would you agree with this, also a very positive view of the world? Or is it?
Star Wars?
Yeah.
I have read an essay about Star Wars that was really, really critical about Star Wars, and I'm talking about the author of I'm having a mental block here. Another sci-fi author who wrote Ender's Game.
Oh, Orson Scott Card. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Orson Scott Card really dislikes Star Wars, and the reason he dislikes it is because it's very elitist. You know, it mm-hmm. doesn't matter so much what happens to the masses of people. What really matters is, you know, saving the soul of Darth Vader, the man who's destroyed planets, you know. And then there's always the guy that, is dead set against, he wants to conquer the Emperor, he wants to do away with all this evil, but if he just gives in to his anger, then all of a sudden he becomes the emperor's slave immediately. And he
right.
says, name a time in history when that has happened. By giving in to anger, you immediately switch sides.
You immediately go from being,
The anger I get at Osama bin Laden, the more likely I am to become a jihadi too. Human nature doesn't really work that way. Those weaknesses said, and I would agree with Orson Scott Card that there are those weaknesses within the series. It's still just a heck of a lot of fun. And the original trilogy, you don't get more fun than the character of Han Solo.
That's right.
And his buddy Chewbacca. And then you have the mystic and his and the young guy that doesn't know much, but he is an adventurous spirit, and he whines a lot about Tashi Station, but he's like us. We whine about things we probably shouldn't have, but we dream of bigger things, and it's just a great story. There's Orson Scott Card might be the only person in the world who doesn't like the story.
he might be. Well, I can understand his critique of it, but yeah, I think it's a little overblown. I think that you've got to take it for the genre it is. And the truth is, in big epic heroic literature, it does always come down to the elite. I mean, when you read mythology, Hercules does all these horrible things. I mean, horrible things he does, but we're still interested in how things come out for him. And I think the characters in something like Star Wars are like that. They're mythic. So it's a different set of rules. But it's true. It's not realistic. And it assumes a moral order to the universe. Moral order to the universe that we no longer assume. That we actually, frankly, reject, but we don't care because we like the story, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Actually, Orson Scott Card would say, "No, you can't do that," right? But
yes, you can.
yeah, I think you can. Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and like it anyway because I think it's fun. Okay, so what's your favorite moment in any of the Star Wars movies?
Well, let's see. when Luke turns off the guidance computer.
Ah.
That was pretty awesome in the original. I'm going to call it Star Wars.
Yes, that's what I always call it. Luke, you've turned off your targeting computer. And he says, I'm all right.
I know.
The music
kind
of rises. Yeah, he's going to use the Force. I always get a chill. That was pretty awesome.
And, of course, and then my second favorite moment would be the entirety of Empire Strikes Back. Yeah.
Yes.
That is the perfect sequel. Has there ever been a sequel so good as Empire Strikes Back? I'm not sure that we've seen a sequel quite that good yet. Although there've been some good sequels. They talked about The Dark Knight being an example of a sequel that shines as bright as as Empire Strikes Back, but I'm not sure.
So, well, we could argue that point. I think Dark Knight is just about the perfect superhero movie, but they're slightly different movies. But I would agree with you that The Empire Strikes Back is an awesome movie. And in fact, my favorite sequence in any of the Star Wars movies has got to be Yoda training Luke. Those scenes just always stuck with me. This wisdom that comes out of Yoda's mouth that I hear myself saying sometimes, my daughter used to say she was going to try to do something and I'd be all, try not, do, or do not. There is no try. It's like Yoda has gotten into our heads, with his.
That's right. A little gather's room,
with his incredible Jedi wisdom. That's right. I love it. So, and what's fun about that is, you've seen the other three, right?
Right.
Do you have a favorite movie from a favorite scene from the other three?
It wouldn't be the first one because Anakin and he was just terrible in that first movie.
Does Jar Jar get killed? If there's a scene where Jar Jar gets killed, that's my favorite scene, but I don't think it happened. So.
No, it didn't happen.
No. That's the problem with the second three, and in the red letter media reviews, they talked about differently. He didn't say favorite scene; he said favorite character. Who's your favorite character in the second trilogy? He would ask people in the first trilogy, and they're all like, "Oh, Han Solo. Oh, I love C-3PO." There's these characters that you believe in and that you're invested in, and there's not in the second trilogy. And I think it's also true with just kind of the story arc. Although I do want to give the movie props. I think the second half of the final movie in the trilogy is very dramatic, very dark, and very effective.
As dark as it needed to be to tell that story. Yeah, I agree completely. That I guess it would probably be the last 15 minutes of the third movie came as close to getting it right as any of it. I thought Natalie Portman as Princess Amidala was she's beautiful, particularly in the second movie. I guess that's about it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. So Natalie Portman is hot, and that's about all we have to say, right? It's hard to take much further than that. And what they point out in those reviews is that there is no one anywhere near to Han Solo in those.
Yeah, there is no Han Solo character.
They didn't even try
to
create a Han Solo-like character, which maybe is just as well, because I think they would have messed it up. But the thing about Han is, Chewie shows up, and we're glad to see him, but the thing about Han is he's a regular guy, and Luke is a regular guy initially, and through the trilogy we see Luke go from being a regular guy to becoming a Jedi Knight, and we see Han go from being a regular guy to being a regular guy. So it's great that you can kind of triangulate Luke's transition around Han, who is in a lot of ways most people's I think favorite character in the. In the series anyway.
Right.
In the second trilogy, or the first trilogy, technically, chronologically speaking, you just don't have that. Everybody is important.
Everybody's a Jedi, usually.
Yeah, everybody's a Jedi,
or
a princess, or a senator, the closest you have to a regular guy is like Jar Jar, right? So
which everybody hated. So, there you are. Yeah, there's the problem with the original trilogy. Jar Jar is our Han.
Yeah.
So, That's it in a nutshell. There's the problem with the first trilogy. So,
yeah, I think we've identified it. And the more we talk about it, the warmer I'm feeling towards Star Wars versus Star Trek, but in addition to Star Trek. I like having both in the world. And this discussion makes me want to whip out the original and watch Han in all his glory. He's the guy we all want to be, right? I mean, we don't want to be Luke.
He plays by his own rules.
Tosche Station.
Yeah, exactly. He plays by his own rules, and he makes the Kessel Run, and all that. He's
1.5 parsecs. Well, he's the guy who shoots Greedo under the table, at least in the original version.
Yeah, and he shot first.
That's right. I'm sure everyone listening, that's very meaningful to you as well as it is to Stephen and myself.
Yeah.
But it's important. It's important that Han shot first. That says something about his character. I mean, that's the regular guy right there. You know, he's not going to wait around to get killed. He's got to take that guy out. So he takes it out. So there it is. Star Wars, terrific series of movies. The first three that were made, the second three in the sequence. And did I hear that George Lucas is now committing to making the next trilogy?
I heard something about us getting some fresh Star Wars of some flavor towards the end of this summer. I think it's some sort of animated movie at the end of the summer.
Oh yeah, he's cranking out more of that kind of stuff. But I believe somebody in the chat room, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Lucas has said he's going to make the next three.
Okay. And that would be the three chronologically following.
Following that, that's right. So we'll pick it up with, I guess, Luke, or not, like Han and Leia's kids or whatever.
Maybe Mark Hamill can come out as our elderly Ben Kenobi character, you know?
Old Luke at this point, right? So
that'd be fun to see. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that does it for our Star Wars discussion, and I guess we should then talk about what our music is this evening.
Absolutely. Let me let everybody know the title of that book by Tobias Buckow was Nascience, 17 Stories That Failed and What They Taught Me. I recommend it to anybody who has any inclination to write science fiction, especially, but really any kind of writing. It's a great book. The music tonight is Serenity by The Fump. Serenity, of course, has a Han Solo character. That would be Mal. The captain of
absolutely.
So anyway, I thought it might be appropriate. I apologize in advance for this guy singing, but listen, the lyrics are pretty hilarious. So anyway, that's
all right. So the song is Serenity. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen, and thank you all for being part of our program tonight. Chat room, glad to see Sally finally got sound. We worked through that drama. Everyone listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back on with The World Transformed 1.5 on Saturday, an archive show on Monday, and back on again live 1 week from tonight. Hope you can join us for all of our upcoming programs. And until next time, live to see it.
This landing is going to get pretty interesting.
Define interest.
Oh, God, we're all going to die?
This is the captain. We have a little problem with our entry sequence, so we may experience some slight turbulence and then explode.
Driving a firefly, such a hassle. Getting yelled at my mouth, he's the king of the castle. Meanwhile, Jane wants to chuck his grenades from the store, and when he runs out, he'll have to buy more. Let's be bad guys, do some thievery. She'll sense that need is deeper. The poor river is naive, her psychic powers felt the reaver. So we leave there with our cash bounty. Thanks to River and Simon who hide on Serenity. Serenity is where they gotta live. They're on the lam like drifter orphans. Meanwhile, the enemy is called the operative, and he's been to the desert. No remorse and no name, a horse opera that's played across the stars. Should have paid off the twins and then rolled down till River told out bruises and scars. When she goes cuckoo for Fruity Odie bars.
I swallowed a bug and ate it, is what River said, but now I'm afraid I'll get turned.
Come on, a year now, I ain't had nothing. Switched my nether, won't run on batteries.
Oh, God. I can't know that.
I could stand to hear a little more.
Mr. Universe talking on the radio, says the whole damn verse is a reality show. Uncovering the numbers in the ad that made her flip, Jane and Mal started to argue about who will run the Goran ship. Well, he can't know it, he's an anagram. Wear an R of that V, she is a piece, always cannot face OP, bomb and flee. They escape from that dollhouse onto Serenity, Serenity. And for a battle loss, it's got a crew of unsung saviors. Zop says that River Tam is just an albatross, and no, you don't get any wafers with it. The mystery that River's head contains is answered by passing by Reavers, which is the biggest fear of James, because all they want to do is eat your brain.
I want a pony and a plastic rocket, Buddha, please. I ain't too busy, hate so forget. I believe a whole planet laid down and said their goodnight. Nobody even read them their Miranda rights. So we brought on a war. I'm a leaf on the wind. Watch how I soar.